I'll sail down the street in my new fancy car. I will rise through the buildings to the sky like a star. There's a house in Eden, even though I've lost my way, and I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay. You're listening Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. Roll down the window and breathe in the air. Blow out the gas. There, there's a house in Eden, and I think I'm on my way, and I'll be there shortly. This is just a brief delay. The lead man at the bank, Mr. Harry Balfour, sits in a black leather chair behind a wall of glass, visible to all the lobby patrons. In the old days, such a senior officer would be kept from the public view, hidden behind locked doors, as an expression of the bank's integrity. Nowadays, apparently, to see is to trust. All the banks in town follow this trend of visible officials. You can't go in one without seeing its managers laying about on the phones or staring at their terminals. In the far corner of his office, he keeps a large, ever-in-flower hibiscus, and here and there, on the random table, stand other ornamental plants, all shiny plastic forgeries. Even the plants and trees spread in the white stone courtyard just outside the bank are fake. On his desk, and a little too close to his working space, Harry Balfour has a fish tank brightly lit with a bubbling deep-sea diver. While not specifically a forgery, there's not a single fish in it, just bubbles, and also the strange element of a slowly circling underwater train, which may be the point of the whole thing, to just have the train going around. Harry Balfour was, I knew, a railroading enthusiast, and also, I knew, the president of the local LRC, the Lemon Railway Club, which had, for the last decade, focused its attentions on restoring an old locomotive. On the back of Harry Balfour's door was a train conductor's cap with a shiny insignia buckle and a narrow black brim, which cap I suppose he wore to his train meetings, which meetings I imagined were called to order with the cry of "All aboard!" I had never in my life spoken to Harry Balfour, nor seen him in the out-of-doors, while yet there was some enigmatic connection between us. Since I'd arrived in Lemon some 15 years ago, I have received, maybe every 2 or 3 months, a mailing from the Lemon Railway Club, letters signed by Harry Balfour. These came in the seemingly generic form of invitations to attend whatever LRC function or fundraiser. But yet, at the bottom of these letters, which I imagined everyone in town got, Harry Balfour would inscribe a personal note in pencil. "Dear Captain S," such notes began, "we would be honored by your company and would enjoy nothing more than discussing your possible membership with the LRC. We remember 58. I had not paid these invitations much mind, but the little personal asides were disquieting. Why did he refer to me as Captain S? And what was it that they were remembering when they remembered 58? The implication was that I could clearly follow this code, that both Captain S and 58 should be obvious references for me. And yet, I was not a captain, and the number 58 was not any more significant to me than 57 or 59. Despite doing his best to give the appearance of a man in the full concern of scanning the dry terms of a loan, I could see, during my last number of visits to the bank, that Harry Balfour was not, in fact, looking at his work. Yes, his head swung left and right, as though that's how heads moved when people were reading, and yes, he fidgeted his glasses to pump and prime his view, and yes, his pen made dashy swipings here and there over the page. But yet, he was not doing a thing. His eyes were set to the peripheries, and he was looking out into the lobby. In fact, it was my growing belief that Harry Balfour was staring, for some undiscoverable reason, at me.
We three, we're all alone, living in a memory. My echo, my shadow, and me. We three, we're not a crowd, we're not even company. My echo, my shadow, and me. What good is the moonlight, the silvery moonlight that shines above? I walk with my shadow, I talk with my echo, but where is the one I love? We three will wait for you, even till eternity. My echo, my shadow, and me.
If it had not been for his scribblings to Captain S and the mention of the widely admired number 58, I suppose I would have thought Harry Balfour was gazing non-specifically and unenthusiastically at the bank's patrons, just looking out at the irksome crowd as they looked in, for it was actually difficult to stand in line and not stare shamelessly at him behind his wall of glass. Perhaps it was the ultra-vivid fluorescence that poured down on him, or the train-based aquarium on his desk, or the sugar-blue quality of his skin, blushed as it was with rosy striations of some lurking ailment. But it all compounded to create the illusion that Harry Balfour never left his office, and this hermetic quality itself gave us bank patrons some leave, I suppose we felt, to openly gawk at him, as we would a mildly activated thoroughly dull museum exhibit. But as I stood on the bank, looking at him, look at me, those two troublesome details flared in my attention, the 58 and the Captainess, and his staring all at once came to seem a companion to his little pencil notes at the bottom of the generic LRC mailings. Yet I was not absolutely certain that I was the subject of his interest. There were always other people in the bank, and perhaps he was just watching them. Even more irksome, I had received a recent summoning from the LRC. They were having a Thanksgiving dinner aboard the finally renovated Flying Yankee train, and though I had barely examined it, on further recollection, I realized that I had noticed a much more significant block of pencil scribbling at the bottom of the invitation. The arrival of this letter coincided with my first sense that Harry was staring at me, and perhaps if I'd bothered to read his memo, it would have shed some light on the current purpose of his scrutiny. A terrible, childlike experiment instantly formed in the center of my seat of purpose, and though I fought hard, I realized that I was about to undertake a series of small and obnoxious tests. First, I would observe Harry Balfour in the state of a seemingly empty bank. To do this, I would literally have to sneak in. Second, I would need to be in the bank alone to catch whether I gathered his eyes. And then, lastly, I would need to determine his behavior when the bank was full of people, but not me. Again, some sneaking would be required. This is the sort of awful, small-minded plan which causes me to groan audibly before I go to bed at night. I returned to the bank the following day. It was an aggravating morning of sun and clouds tossing each other in a kind of combat. Late November is a restless time. The first smoky cold, apple scent of snow bristles on the air like a kind of distantly cooking frost. I sat alone on the cold stone bench outside the bank, watching the sky for snowflakes. I checked my watch just before 10. I rustled my shoes over the white, decorative stones. To do my awful tests, I was utilizing the one helpful bit of ritual that Harry Balfour employed. At 10 a.m. every morning, he turned his large chair to the side, opened a low cabinet, and over the course of a single minute, he consumed what I guessed were vitamin tablets or medical pills, and for that minute, his back would be entirely turned to the main lobby, as though to take a pill were a kind of shame. I was waiting, hopefully, for the lone female customer in the bank to emerge. At 9:59, I sat forward on the bench, reached down toward my shoes, and tugged the laces free. At 10 seconds to 10, I pushed through the first of two doors, simultaneously excited and depressed to see the lone woman customer walking toward me. At 15 seconds after the hour, I pushed the door open for her to exit, and I myself entered. A quick glance established that Harry Balfour was in the full shame of his pills, and I strolled quietly over the polished luxury of the bank floor. As I reached the solid block of the public counter, I patted my pockets as though they contained large sums of cash, which I hoped to deposit, and then, oh my goodness, look at that, my shoes are untied. I fell toward them, like a hawk toward two lace-eared rabbits, and disappeared behind the counter. I tossed my hands around for a moment over my shoes, and then peered around the low edge of the public counter. Would Harry Balfour be hard at work? Or would his strange eyes be gazing out into the empty lobby? There was an ambitious moment of blurring as I attempted to find him from my strange perspective. And when I finally set eyes on him, a kind of aching shock fell to my soul. For despite my great elusiveness, Harry Balfour was staring directly at me, and then smiling and waving down toward me, and then standing from his black chair, and then moving through his office, buttoning his coat. I found myself standing in a woozy state, laces untied, elderly purple dizziness watering my mind, as Harry Balfour opened his never-opened office door and came out to meet Captain S, with, I was sure, some intention of going over the wondrous memory of 58.
Little field mice living under the house, never eaten much tough life for a mouse. And if you think you're gonna be spared, you're wrong. Field mice, head lice, spiders in the kitchen. Don't think twice about whatever keeps you itching. Ice water, fly swatter, gonna get you through the day. Beauty is rolling in like hell's red rug, stinking like the breath of Beelzebub. And if you think you won't walk on coals, you will. Field mice, head lice, spiders in the kitchen. Don't think twice about whatever keeps you itching. Ice water, fly swatter, gonna get you through the day. The day.
Harry Balfour had his arm out, in the far-off politician's way of turning the world into a place where one predominantly shook hands. And he was striding vigorously across the wet appearance of the floor. I stood weakly in the ruin of my espionage, wondering if my own arm could be driven to an appointment with his. Had this meeting come about in any other way, I would have had no trouble. But I had been caught red-handed in the midst of a dubious mission. Captain, Harry Balfour said brightly. I took his hand and shook it, surprised by its strength and warmth. It's good to see you outside the zoo, I said amiably. Harry Balfour smiled and drew an envelope from his pocket. I wanted to give you this in person, he said, and perhaps see if there's anything I can do to convince you. His face grew serious, and as he extended the white envelope, I saw Captain S scribbled on the front. I took it and inhaled in the sort of way that suggested that I understood what he was asking. We understand, of course, he continued. Not everyone is vetted out to be a part of a club, but we were hoping just this once you might consider it. It would mean so much to the LRC. So much. Really capped the evening off, and of course you'd be welcome to join in the Thanksgiving dinner with us. There's only a handful of us old cranks now, but we like to think we can still have some fun. I nodded pleasantly at all this. I'll consider it, I said. It's been 50 years, Harry whispered, as though the weight of these years was something he and I had long held between us. And we've been planning this dinner in the dark for almost 20 years, he continued. Since the first moment we got the Flying Yankee down to the depot, we thought we must do a reenactment. And when you moved to town, my goodness, we were thrilled. It's like fate, we said, that the captain should return. Pieces of the puzzle and all that. We in the club, of course, get terrifically excited, and then we travel out into the community. And no one quite follows what it is that we're all so gung-ho about. Harry Balfour swung a melancholy gung-ho arm through the air. At any rate, he continued, If it's too much, you could simply just join us for the dinner and forget the speech. Free, of course, just part of the club's ongoing thanks to you. But if you would, consider participating. Even just a brief excerpt from the speech to start things off, you would make 9 or 10 old gentlemen of the railway very happy, very happy. He reached quickly for my hand, tears touching the points of his eyes, and I was shocked to find the condition of his flesh much altered over the course of our brief conversation. The warm hand had become cold and sweaty. The vigorous striding politician who'd come out to meet me now returned to his office, deflated, like a man who'd played his cards badly. In a kind of sad distraction, as he closed his door, I saw him take down his train conductor's hat, and as he sat at his desk, full of its piles of similar thick forms, he absently set the cap in place on his head, touched the wetness of his eyes with a tissue, and I may be wrong, but I believed I saw him sing out quietly to himself two earnest little words, "All aboard."
Does not exist, take an exit. I hear voices insinuating, feeds me words to this song that I'm singing. Sunlight, 7:20 p.m. early September, standing looking at a photograph you don't remember. You look out of breath at me like I'm faking. As a matter of fact, I don't recall don't actually exist, so I started shaking. Does not exist, take an exit.
Once home in my cabin, I instantly set up a brandy and a bowl of pretzels. I stoked the fire, sat in a soft chair near the window, drew a blanket to my lap, and I tore open the envelope and extracted the letter. It was not the typical LRC invitation. It was simply a brief note written in pencil from Harry Balfour. I took a sip of my bright, bitter drink, reached for the pretzels, and began to read it. "Dear Captain Sherwin," it began, "it seems incredible, but we are coming upon the 50th anniversary of the great debate of 58. You, of course, served us so well that evening, going well beyond the call of duty with your rousing, poetical speech, which capped our great night in a way none of us has ever forgotten. Living in New York then, as you did, and having the life of a busy train conductor, you could not possibly know what happened next to our little railway group. Of course, we made our stand, but yet we came inevitably, figuratively and literally, to the end of the line. After the railroad company officially closed, we former employees created a kind of club, the LRC Flying Yankee, and it's been our business over the last 2 decades to restore 3 of the original cars from the Flying Yankee Railway. The line you yourself drove for us on that most memorable night. To commemorate the recently completed restoration, we have planned a special reenactment to revisit that infamous dinner in the dark of so many years ago. We have made our desires to have you as a member quite clear in the past, but we understand your lack of interest. We did, however, hope to conscript you for one night only to fulfill your original role, to come with us on our 4-mile journey along the branch line many of us helped to build, stopping finally in the Valley Transit Tunnel, as we did in 1958. And there, in the darkness, beneath Market Mountain, at the end of the line, we will have our celebratory supper. It is chief in our desires that you might read the speech you gave that night, which so reflected the common feeling and described our human plight and set us free, as far as such things might, from the burden of what then seemed an enormous calamity. This will be an intimate atmosphere in the dining car, along with a slideshow and excellent turkey dinner. Good brandy, cigars if you like them, good company, good spirits, fine memories. We hope for this one night you might set aside your reservations and join us. Warmest regards, Harry Balfour. Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. Part 2 of The Dinner in the Dark will continue in a moment. You're listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. There are two stretches along Main Street which bump over the rails, one right in the center of town, and then once again where things start getting wild. Crossing these tracks on foot, one can see the rails, alive and bright, with seeming use. As one continues through the center, one passes over the traveling bridge and gets a grander view of the river, and further down, the square and slightly exotic tile roof of the train depot can be seen, set out beyond a lower, rusty trestle. As I often walk through town, down Main Street and over the traveling bridge, I had seen the burnt-out husk stranded beside the depot. Three grey-black cars with broken windows and crushed plating. Over the years, I watched the cars grow silvery and new as the LRC revitalized it. And I saw the Flying Yankee the next day as I crossed the bridge for the library. It was another cold morning full of mischief and possible snow, and I was relieved to get away from the biting bluster and step into the warmth of the library. I headed down into the dim basement, looking for the cinder block researcher's room. I took off my coat and gloves and sat on a hard chair at an unoccupied station and began to flick through the microfiche pages of the Lemon Times for the year 1958, searching for whatever railroading debacle had occurred which had prompted this coming reenactment of a dinner in the dark. In particular, I hoped to discover the true identity of the mysterious Captain S. If I could discover who he was, I thought I might then provide Harry Balfour with an appropriate correction that he might attempt in the next few hours to contact the real Captain S, possibly in time to invite him to undertake the dreaded speech. As to my own history, the year of 1958 would have found me in New York, a biographical feature I shared with Captain S. From 1957 through 1959, I lived at the Mattersley Arms on 33rd Street and was employed by the Stansfield Theatre as a regular cast member of their eclectic productions. I digested headlines and photographs, keenly skimming around for signs of the captain. As I read and searched, the grander picture formed. The great debate itself centered on the potential closing of the Lemon Railway project. Huge sums of money had been poured into this significant venture that sought to connect the rail lines on either side of the mountains. The scheme involved 8 or so miles of new track and the excavation of an enormous tunnel through Market Mountain. When the construction company charged with the work went into bankruptcy, the debate began. The project itself, by all estimates, was almost 95% complete. The track had been all but laid, and the tunnel had almost come through on the far side. The question then stood, should the townspeople foot the bill to complete the tunnel? In doing so, they would take ownership of this section of the line. Control of the depot would mean that usage fees would go directly to the town coffers, offsetting the tax rolls. And of course, there would be a great benefit to all. Having a local station would mean thriving business for local merchants. The town of Lemon, so the argument went, was on the cusp of becoming a gateway city. Public opinion was strongly on the side of finishing the tunnel and completing the project. The problem was, of course, as the town council rightly pointed out, that railway travel was giving significant signs of obsolescence. The council argued that trains were not the future of personal transportation. Automobile ownership was up tremendously every year. Lines were shutting down here and there, and railroad companies going bankrupt. The tunnel and the additional work would take 2 years, possibly more, and almost $2 million. The debate raged. Gateway city, town ownership versus obsolescent mode of travel. Citizens versus town council. In a surprising late November maneuver, the town council drew up a secret midnight quorum and voted against the risky project, but in a roundabout way. They condemned the tunnel as an unsafe architectural construction, and a company out of Maine was hired to demolish it. But the LRC was not done yet. They carried out a series of formal demonstrations, brought in experts and engineers from across the country to sign and verify the safety of the tunnel. And on the day just before Thanksgiving in 1958, as the Maine demolition crew began to rig the tunnel up with their charges, 30 local families climbed aboard the Flying Yankee and rode out into the condemned and incomplete tunnel as a sign of their trust in it and to protest the city council's ruling. In this tunnel and in this train, 50 years ago, by candlelight, the people of Lemon shuffled along to the dining car and had their Thanksgiving dinner in the dark, a meal which began with a brief toast given by a conductor hired out of New York, a man the Lemon Times identified as Captain Show and Sleeves. And there he was in a grainy picture in the lower right-hand margin of the page, a thin, dark-bearded man with longish hair and round spectacles, standing at one end of the dining car, lifting his champagne glass. And I had no doubt, seeing the image, that it was me. Beneath the photograph of Captain Sherwin Sleeves, the Lemon Times had placed a snippet of his apparently powerful speech. "I run trains for a living," the speech began. "That's what I do, and I'm not good at much else, and I don't know if I'm good at this." It was with these words, finally, that reality struck, as there, unfurling in my consciousness, was the smallest, mildest scene. A not important and never yet considered span of hours in my life. According to the math, I would have been 29 years old when I went out to Lemon to do this particular chore. Had you asked me if I had ever appeared in Corradella's play, The Dishonest Conductors, I would have said yes, for I had. I wouldn't have been able to say exactly when or where or who the other principals were, just that I had. I wasn't the lead, but I had a few speeches. I recall the train conductor's costume with its large golden buttons. But whether I got good reviews, who directed it, how long the run was, I have no idea. My relationship to the world has always been gravely tenuous. I have never been good with street names, with dates, with topographies. I can't remember who's who in town unless it's been blasted into my head with name tags and repetition. The shape and structure of most things eludes me. Rules, formulas. I get lost easily. I cannot remember recipes for simple dishes I prepare regularly. I have kept myself mostly from owning cars, as I'm so bad with them. I crash them, or fail to take care of them, or run out of gas in them, or forget where I've left them, or forget, for long stretches, to use them. From my perspective, good or bad, it has been a ghostly life, full of ghostly things. In seeing the photograph of Captain Sherwin Sleeves in the dining car, and reading the selection from his speech, I was at once at the core of the central experience of my life, of both being myself and witnessing myself as a kind of stranger, for it was both me there in the old picture and not me, and I suppose I have spent my life attempting to bring these two together, or discard one, or forget the other. What I remember is that I was doing Coriolis, the dishonest conductus. After one of the performances, a gentleman approached me with a question. He wondered if I could teach him a bit of the monologue I'd given at the end of the play. Did I have a copy, or could he write it down? He told me his purpose, that he was a train conductor and had been hired out for a special one-night drive in New Hampshire. And after hearing my speech, he felt that it might exactly suit the occasion. I did not have a copy of the play. Neither of us had a pen. We went to his car to find something to write with. He offered me a bottle. It started to snow. We drank a little as he searched beneath his car seats. With the cold and the snow, we soon settled into the car to discuss options. And I suppose, from loneliness, or lack of purpose, or from a place of needing to help, I suggested that I go with him. He would conduct the train, and I would conduct the speech. I don't remember much else, but for a single image of myself standing in the bright vista of the dining car, raising my glass to the strange, unknown townspeople, hoping, for their sake and mine, that the tunnel did not collapse around us as I delivered the final speech of the play. The library lights flickered for closing time. I stirred from my dreams and memories and settled my winter coat over my shoulders in the buzz of the basement. I wandered up the stairs toward the door. It was dismal dark out. As I buttoned my coat in the cold air of the front lobby, I found myself mumbling out the opening snatches of the Coriolis speech, until I was speaking it into the air. The complete speech, I could feel it inside me, alive and well.
We're all in it, and we all in it, and we all in it, and we close our eyes. We're all in it, and we all in it, and we all in it, and we close our eyes. We're all in it, and we all in it, and we all in it, and we close our eyes. We're all in it, and we all in it, and we all in it, and we close our eyes. Close our eyes, close our eyes. We're all in it, and we close our eyes.
As I crossed the bridge, I saw the shining silver body of the train sparkling beside the depot. From this distance, the Flying Yankee looked like a kind of sinister barracuda on rails, restless and hungry, sleek and slope-headed. I cut down the hill into the darkness on the far side of the Traveller's Bridge. A few old gentlemen in black suits milled on the platform, puffing cigars, laughing and chatting with excitement. I was preparing to emerge from the unlit stretch along the river and cross toward them when I saw Harry Balfour hustling over the rails to intercept me. "Captain Sherwin," he said with pleasure. We shook hands, and he urged me along privately. "They're a slow group," he said, laughing, "and I don't think they saw you. We'll just sneak you around here, into the observation car. You'll be a bit of a surprise for them, is what I'm thinking, if you don't mind." He gestured toward a darkened stairway at the back of the observation car. "We surely didn't expect you," Harry Balfour said as he followed me up the stairs and I stepped into the warmth of the observation car. There was an encircling row of plush violet theta chairs running the entire cabin and a kind of old-fashioned, dim yellow lighting. I took a seat near the front and gazed out the high windows at the silver tracks rising toward the trestle. "You'll find everything you need right there." Harry Balfour gestured to a garment bag hanging from a ceiling hook. Without another word, he disappeared into the next car. I drew the garment bag zipper down and felt the heavy, dark coat and pants inside. I saw the golden buttons on the conductor's jacket. On the seat below was Harry's conductor's cap. And below that was a key prop that I'd assumed we'd have to do without. At the end of the play, my character gives a speech as to his own purpose in the world, and this culminates in the presentation of a sketch pad filled with the drawings he'd done as a boy. It is a key moment as he turns the sketchbook around for the audience to see its contents. 50 years ago, I simply used the prop we'd had for the play. But tonight, I would be using Harry Balfour's own book of sketches. I took the golden button suit from the bag, laid the cap atop my head. The anxiety of performance sent an excited shiver through my gullet. I had a speech to give. The play had not yet ended. A few moments later, there was a feeling of slipping and silence, and I noted that we'd begun to glide forward. A long series of whistles then blew, and a muffled cheer rose from the dozen old fellows in the adjoining dining car. The train's headlight burned against the mist of the foggy night ahead. Tiny flakes of snow appeared and scattered like dust in all directions. We rose carefully along the series of hills that build toward the mountains. As we entered the south side of the McCaw Meadows, we leveled and continued along a raised bunker. The trees grasped around us again on the far side of the meadow, and the snow blew heavier like a smoke of paper. There was a mild squeal of brakes, and then the train whistle bellowed nervously against the mountain pines, and the train slowed. I stared hard through the front window of the observation car, through the tangle of snow, trying to see the cavernous opening ahead, until there was a wide, swallowing blackness, and we entered the tunnel. Throughout its length, we slowed and whistled, and I heard the old men call out each time their happiness, until the train chuffed to a final halt. A moment later, Harry Balfour stepped in. He checked the buttons of my coat, adjusted my cap, brushed the hair on my shoulders back. He lifted the book of drawings from the chair, and I tucked it under my arm. "This was my sketchbook from when I was a boy. My book of trains," he said. "I suppose I always wanted to do what you did. I suppose most of us here feel the same way." Harry Balfour stopped himself, and then, very sweetly, drew me forward, as though I was something that could be led by a string that needed pulling along. He opened the door to the dining car to reveal a bright white vista and a rising rich scent of pepper and cream, clove and butter. He stood behind me, and I strode forward, tipping my hat to the old seated gentleman. They stared wide-eyed and bewildered, as though undecided whether or not it was really me, a sentiment I shared exactly. A champagne glass was delivered to my hand, and I drifted it toward the ceiling at the speed of their understanding. two of the old fellows now stood, and then soon we were all standing, with glasses raised, as we had 50 years before. "Lights," Harry Balfour called, and the row of sconces above the old passengers yellowed and then guttered off, and we waited to adjust to the candles flickering on the tables. "I run trains for a living," I said. "That's what I do, and I'm not good at much else, and I don't know if I'm good at this. Sometimes you wonder whether, maybe, something else might have suited you better. I used to draw as a boy, and made these great books full of drawings. When I was a young man, I fancied I'd someday be an artist. But I suppose when it comes down to it, all I ever hoped for is that I could be of some service to the world. Some service to you here tonight. That's how I got into trains in the first place. Someone said, 'Would you do this job shoveling coal?' And I said yes, because I needed work. And then someone said, 'There's a problem here. Could you fix this broken engine?' And I said yes, because I'd learned some things about the motor. And then someone said, 'We need a driver tomorrow and the next, and we think you can drive.' And I said yes, because I did know how. Although every once in a while, for a long time running, I would wonder about my drawing, about whether I could have done that, been an artist, with an entirely different life. But then I'd find myself sitting up front of the train, watching for trouble. And that's when I'd know I have the right job, because I have a direct interest. It's not a difficult job, but there's a responsibility. There are lives at stake, in the train and outside the train. I'm responsible for both, and there are things in the way, on the tracks, what I'm looking for, and I remain focused the entire time, watching the tracks, which is really the heart of the matter. As you all know, these things aren't easy beasts to stop. From a full head of steam, they'll take a mile sometimes, and you'd be surprised by how many things are in the way. People, animals, vehicles, strange crates, metal objects. There's always something in the tracks, just there in the distance a quarter mile ahead. A cow, a little girl, a tree. That's about as far as you can see, a quarter mile. Of course, my job is to avoid disaster at all costs. That's the principal directive of my job, which is why I watch. That's my interest and responsibility. But the trouble is, there isn't any way. Not in a quarter mile with a full head of steam, not a single way to prevent it. By the time you've seen the little girl there on the tracks, it's too late to stop the train. Of course, you throw the brakes, you go madly at the whistles, you make a quick decision in the deepest part of your body. You throw the brakes at once, but nothing gets changed by the brakes, because by the time you've seen it, it's too late. So I've tended my side of the disaster. I shoveled coal for a while, and then they said, 'Would you drive this train?' And I said yes. And I sometimes wonder whether I should have kept drawing, whether I was perhaps meant to be an artist. And then I look here, in my book of drawings, at my boyhood sketches, and I know exactly where I should be. I lifted Harry Balfour's sketchbook, his own long-ago pencil drawings, faded and mute. I turned the tablet around for the old gentleman of the railroad to get a glimpse of the small sketches scattered across the pages. Hopeful pictures of cabooses, boxcars, drawings of long trains going over sharp mountains, of locomotives pushing over rickety trestles, close-ups of engines, of hobos walking down empty tracks, conductors waving merrily at children. I suppose I was just lucky. Someone asked me to shovel that coal so that I'd be able to find my purpose, watching out the front window, throwing the brakes when my body tells me, doing my best to avoid the disaster, which is the only thing any of us can do. Throw the brakes and hope for the best. As I closed the book, a man at every table reached forward to snuff out the candle, as had happened 50 years ago. And for a long moment, we stood there, in the quiet darkness of ourselves, together and still alive.
Freight train, run so fast. Freight train, run so fast. Please don't tell what train I'm on. They won't know what route I'm gone. When I am dead and in my grave, no more good time. Yeah, I crave. Place the stones at my head and feet. Tell them all that I'm gone to sleep. Freight train, run so fast. Freight train, run so fast. Please don't tell what train I'm on. They won't know. Lord, bury me deep, way down on old Chelsea Street. Then I can hear old number nine as she come rolling by. Freight train, run so fast. Freight train, run so fast. Don't tell what train I'm on. They won't know what route I'm gone.
You've been listening to Atoms, Motion, and the Void on New Hampshire Public Radio. For more information on the show, please visit www.nhpr.org or my own website at www.radioghost.com.